time.
Good evening, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many such lodges scattered around the face of the earth, each being an autonomous entity, an association, that is, of inquirers and seekers of truth, volunteers all, who are involved with the cause of keeping the philosophy alive and well for consideration by the public and for serious study by those who are so inclined to understand the nature of the universe, the workings of the universe, and certainly to explore the concepts of universal brotherhood in every compartment of nature. The activities of this lodge are sustained by voluntary efforts and contributions of interested individuals, many of whom affiliate themselves with the cause, and therefore keep all the activities focused on the basis of the philosophy and the study of the philosophy. So while the activities of this particular lodge are open to the public and certainly welcoming to the public, with absolutely no delineation or limits on who may avail themselves of the information, the true call is one heart to heart for folks that are interested to truly look into the philosophy, study it, apply it as best they can, and fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. We have several meetings here in the building, and this is a unique weekend, if you will, because here we are on the third Friday of the month, following an objective set down by the original Theosophical Society, and that is to compare religions and philosophies and sciences in an earnest effort to glean the truth behind each and all. And as of tonight, every third Friday of the month, the building opens at 6:30, and this meeting starts from 7 to 8 very, very promptly. This evening, of course, we're looking into Taoism and the Quiet Way. And the next third Friday will be May 20th. At which time Confucianism, the path of balance, will be discussed. Tomorrow, there is an activity in this same room. The building will open at 12:30. The meeting will start at 1 and will last until 3:30, 2.5 hours. This is a periodic session, if you will. Students volunteer to do a general presentation for the good of the public. And tomorrow's topic is what you don't know about karma. There will be 6 short talks on different aspects of karma with ample time for questions and answers and discussion with a brief break in between 2 sets of 3 talks, if you will. And you can pick up information about that presentation at the desk in the foyer. Wednesdays, the building is really hopping. 5:30 in the afternoon, the doors open, and for 2 hours, there's a reference library in the front of this floor available to anyone who wants to come in and look at the straight line theosophical literature. So if you hear something in a session and you're more curious about studying that in depth, or if you have a life's problem and you would like to look at some information to work through that problem. If there's something that you would like to prepare for an upcoming class, you can do all of that in the reference library. There's always a volunteer available to help with the search for information. At 7:45 promptly on Wednesday nights, there is a more informal study group. And at that time, the ocean of Theosophy will be discussed. Each week there is a different topic under consideration. This coming Wednesday night is a third part of the 14th chapter of the Ocean on Cycles, and that class will last from 7:45 until 9. Sunday mornings, there's a more formal presentation, one that kind of flows from Sunday to Sunday. For the month of April, we're looking at spiritual knowledge, and this coming Sunday is April 17th. The title for that particular presentation is The Little Universe Called Man. And the building, again, will open at 10:30. There will be an 11 to 12 session. And at any time during library hours, before and after any one of these presentations, there's a book table in the foyer. And if you're interested in volunteering or donating, you can see the person seated at the book table. If you are interested in doing home study, there's a couple of ways to approach it. We offer hard copies of pamphlets, periodicals, and books at cost. No profit to be made on what is considered our spiritual heritage, our intellectual heritage as well. Or you can go online, and there are certain lodges around the world who have scanned all of the literature and have put it up on the net. It can be downloaded for free at any time. Phoenix ULT is one that comes to mind with that. So having said that, tonight's study of comparative religions is focused on Taoism and the quiet way. We've planned to kick the talk off, or the discussion off, with a presentation of the roots of Taoism, the roots of modern times, if you will, of Taoism, to be followed by a discussion of the literature that came forth during that movement. Lao Tzu is an interesting figure in history. Certainly, he lived in a time period when historical writing was available, and we have independent scholarly information about his life. But having said that, there is a lot of open-ended kind of legend and mystery that has grown up around this particular individual. So as you consider Lao Tzu, let's put him in the light of theosophy, of this eternal wisdom religion, if you will. Like Mr. Judge, and certainly like Mr. Crosby, philosophers from the late 1800s, there is minimal biographical information available. He was called gentle, supreme, and calm. He was titled by many Eastern scholars in Oriental departments of study as the first of the great philosophers of China. And again, when you think about gentle and patient and sweet and calm, certainly Judge and Crosby both come to mind as well. The name Lao Tzu itself is actually an honorarium, a title. Like the Christ, like the Buddha, this is not a surname, a family name, and a primary name, but rather this honorary title, translated, has to do with the ancient, the master, the elder, or the sage. And this coming from a land where the veneration of the ancients, the venerations of the ancestors, is very, very important. H.P.B. Blavatsky, writing in the late 1800s, termed the Lao Tzu incarnation as being godlike. And that certainly is remarkable praise coming from such a source. There are questions about the birth and the death dates. In general, the original Lao Tzu, the one that we're discussing this evening, is said to have lived in the mid-6th century before the Common Era, probably born around 604 and certainly dying or being off the scene by 581. You will note, therefore, that when you're thinking about the time period, you're thinking about a time period where he is contemporary with Confucius in China, Confucius being a tad bit later. He is contemporary as well with Zoroaster in Persia, and certainly he is in about the same time period as Gautama the Buddha in India. Confucius is one of the independent sources for information about this character, Lao Tzu. And he talked about dragons, which will become very familiar to a student of theosophy, the universal symbol or term for the adept. Confucius wrote, "For the dragon, I cannot know how he ascends on the winds and the clouds to heaven. He is as difficult to understand as the dragon. He teaches the vitality of the Tao and leads one to aspire after self-effacement and obscurity." So there's a degree of quiet humbleness and this great depth, if you will, of spiritual wisdom resident in this venerable one. In terms of the birth accounts, it's very, very, very interesting. As the decades went on, as the centuries progressed and Taoism developed, it was said that he was born of a virgin mother, that he was conceived at the sight of a meteor, a great star in the sky, and that he was born with a white beard in a violet-hued aura, and that he was long-eared. Now, the white beard certainly can go with the symbolism of a wise old soul coming once again. Or we know in the European traditions there is a story of masked babies being born where there's little scarring on the outer edges of the ears and there's an extra film of membrane across the face. And babies born that way are said to be very, very wise or precocious or psychic in a certain way. So we can see certain similarities with other religious figures around the world and certain symbolism involved as well. His proper name was probably Li-er. Li being the family surname, meaning plum, and Er referring to ears. The symbolism of long fleshy ears throughout Asia, certainly in statues of the Buddha as well, has to do with a symbolism of one who can listen to the voice of the silence, one who is enlightened enough to be perceptive so that intuition, conscience, comes through full bloom. He was born in the state of Chu in the Ku province, and all that information comes to us by an independent historical source of a famous historian, Chi Ma Chen. He was known for skills in astrology, divination, and was called wise. He was a scholar or historian, a Shi. In other words, he was an archivist of the secret doctrines and texts for the Chinese government in the state of Thu. He was a custodian and he was the editor. And here we have interesting parallels. If you think about the life of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, as a preserver, a synthesizer, and a transmitter of ancient spiritual wisdom, someone who codified the old and the very pure records and kind of organized them and put them into a digested form and then brought them forward. Lao Tzu is said to have done the same thing in the resuscitation efforts of Taoism. Throughout the writings in this philosophy since the 1800s, the parallel has been said that what Lao Tzu did for China, HPB did for the world. He was very clear that he rediscovered these documents of Taoism, and although he is said to have written 1,000 items, 930 of which are books, and 70 were on magic in particular, another parallel pops up. When the Buddhist missionaries sweep over China, there were fires that occurred, and some of them seemed to be spontaneous combustion. There was one such fire in 213 before the Common Era, and that fire wiped out most of the original texts of Lao Tzu. For some of us, we might recall what happened in Alexandria, Egypt, with the library there and the fires there. Like Buddha, Confucius, Christ, Muhammad, HPB, Lao Tzu was said to have been a reformer. He was born in a time of warring states. There was a corrupt court, and he worked at bringing the Aryan Age into China. Eventually, the accounts go on that he left his post, saying his career was done, there was nothing more he could do for the corrupt state, and he went west. Now, in that term, he was traveling west toward India, and when he disappeared from the scene, never to be seen again, he was heading toward the Himalayas and Tibet. On his way west, he was recognized by a soldier who was keeping the gate of Shenku Pass and checking papers and whatnot. And this soldier, Yin He, recognized him and recognized him as someone who was leaving and pleaded with him. "I've never been able to hear you talk. I've never been able to read one of your books, but I have studied you from afar. Isn't there something you can leave behind for us before you leave China?" And in that nugget, we see parallels to the colloquy between Krishna and Arjuna, where someone who has earned a particular degree of knowledge is able to converse with a great one, with an elder, and gain some information. Well, in this case, we can picture Lao Tzu stopping, sitting by the side of the road, picking up a brush and ink, and quickly dashing off 500 ideograms, 500 Chinese characters. And that 500 characters becomes the Tao Te King, or Tao Te Ching. I'm not sure which way to say it. But that little 500 character book, or tract, opens itself to intuitive reading. They are pictograms. There are many different ways to interpret those pictograms, but it's left behind for it as a nugget for at least a couple of hundred years as a timeless, safe representation of ancient wisdom that had occurred throughout the centuries, as far back perhaps as 2697 in China, bubbling up from time to time as need be. Since his disappearance or passing from the scene, there have been, like the Shakespearean accounts, all sorts of debates. Were there multiple personages? Did they, across the next 200 or 300 years, all write of Taoism and all produce a body of information? And that would be, of course, up to each of us to read into the literature and compare and evaluate.
In today's world, Taoism is considered a religion. And it really, well, in many ways it has turned into one, but it really is a philosophy. And everyone should read the Tao Te King. We do have a publication at the book table that has the Upanishads and the Tao Te King, which is very short, but well worth reading. For most of us, that's all we know about Taoism. Oh, that and the symbol of yin and yang, that comes from Taoism. But there is another document, and it's one we are going to focus on tonight. It's called The Quiet Way. It was written not later than 1600 in the Common Era, and it's a religious and ethical work that stresses Lao Tzu's injunction that man should himself imitate the quiet ways of heaven. The author of The Quiet Way is unknown, but it is an expression of Lao Tzu's wisdom. Whoever wrote it was a student of Lao Tzu. The Quiet Way stresses that just as the sun shines on everyone and everything, whether cunning or kind, whether criminal or beneficent, The sun shines equally on all, and so should the one who follows the quiet way. He, and of course we mean he or she, he should do good to all his fellows, show mercy, benevolence, and kindness towards all. And this includes the lower kingdoms as well. He should have an impartial spirit and do all of this without hope of any reward and without any desire for anyone to notice or praise him. It's like Christ's injunction not to let our right hand know what our left hand is doing. Because if you're following the quiet way, it's not necessary for anyone to know it but you. Although if you really are following the quiet way, and you will see, people will notice it. So here are some of the instructions that we are asked to honor in the writing, The Quiet Way. And you can find it on the web, a site called Sacred Texts. And this is just a partial expression. There's many more of them. We sort of summarize them together under headings. How to treat others, including the lower kingdoms. Practice benevolence whenever you find an opportunity, and let your deeds of merit be unheeded. Now, we think that's very important because we often, all of us, overlook little opportunities to hold a door for somebody, to hold an elevator till someone gets on. Practice benevolence whenever you find an opportunity. The smallest gesture matters. Benefit all creatures. Save your clothing and provisions that ye may befriend the hungry and the cold. If your own family is well provided, extend help to your relatives. If the harvest fails, provide for and relieve your neighbors and friends. Treat your servants with generosity and consideration. Do not expect perfection, nor be too strict in your demands. Buy captive animals and set them free. Next, the attitude necessary if we're going to walk the quiet way. Let your deeds of merit be unheeded. That is repeated over and over. In other words, if our motive is to be noticed and appreciated, it's not really a deed of merit. It's a deed for self-gratification. Let your heart be impartial. We all have unknown, unrecognized prejudices. We may have inherited them from a family attitude or school or where we grew up or the religion we were raised under. We have those prejudices. Until we unmask them in ourselves, we cannot be impartial. So we have to wrestle with that part of our nature. Recognize and become one who sees all as part of oneself. Be filial and obedient to parents. Be lenient with others, but exacting with yourself. Practice goodness, acquire merit. Let go of hatred and forgive malice. Always have in mind helpful sayings. And this one, we think, is absolutely key. Do not assert with your mouth what your heart denies. The duty to the community. And if you've ever read any of Chinese history, you will see reflections of some actual practices that the entire country did. serve the community, supply the means to give instruction to people of talent. Now imagine that as a charity. Supply the means to provide the instruction for people of talent. Establish philanthropical institutions for the education of children. Publish and make known the sutras and the tracts. Build and repair temples and shrines. Distribute medicine to alleviate the suffering of the sick. With tea or water, relieve the distress of the thirsty. Light lanterns in the night to illuminate where people walk. Now, we can't do that, granted, but there are some things we can do that relate that way. You're walking down the street and you see something someone might trip over. You can see it because you have good eyesight. Pick it up and take it to the trash, because someone may be coming along who won't be able to see it. And you're doing it as a service. You don't want anybody to say thank you. You just want to protect that next person. Cut the brambles and the thorns that obstruct the highway. Well, you know, there are people that do that in our country now. A highway is named after a certain group of people, a portion of it, and they maintain it. Remove bricks and stones that lie in the path. Keep boats on rivers to ferry people across. Now, we don't know if you're aware of it, but in ancient China, they had little pagoda-like structures on posts every so often. And people who had money would put money into those little boxes. And anyone who didn't have money could come and take what they wanted, or what they needed, really. And it was expected that if they ever had the opportunity, they would put money in for someone else. It was a natural practice of trusting only those who needed would take, and those who could provide were happy to do it. So for us, it's probably the desire to help that will help us think of ways, even in small ways, that we could do things. Going back to Lao Tzu and how this ties in with the quiet way, he said, "I transmit teachings, I do not create them. I try to describe the ancient tradition, as was said. And what concerns me, Lao Tzu, is neglecting to improve my character, neglecting my studies, failing to move forward when I see the right course, failing to correct myself when I see my mistake. I'm not born a wise man. I'm merely one in love with ancient studies, and I work very hard to learn them. But do you think I learned a great deal and remember it all? No. I have a central thread that runs through it all." And to one who had failed, he is supposed to have said, and we'd like to conclude with this, because it's ennobling. Imagine a spiritual teacher saying this to you after you had failed. "Despair only adds to a man's ills. Go home. Act as if today, for the first time, you had learned the true value of life, and use every moment of it rightly. Even now you may attain to the wisdom you missed." And that wisdom is found in the Tao Te Ching and the Quiet Way. So your questions are invited.
So why did he leave China if he had all this wisdom? Or is he Was he an actual, maybe we should ask it this way, was he an actual embodied person?
HPB says that he was like godlike.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he was a genuine living person. We think that he left China because he was finished and had done all he could.
Yeah.
And we think he was seeking his rest and refinement so he could come back and help us all over again.
There are also, I want to say legends, but because they're not historical accounts, that he actually traveled into Tibet and India and assumed the position of the Buddha. So that would substantiate his degree of enlightenment, if you will, as HPB stated. And if he was as enlightened as HPB said, we trust that he was, he had a working knowledge of cycles, and he would have known if that was the end of his work in one nation and when to move out. The fact that he was available, and this is a historical fact, that he was available to that gatekeeper, and isn't that an interesting symbolism? He was in the right place at the right time to write down those 500 characters, little sonnets, if you will. And that's what survived that tremendous fire 300-400 years later.
Yes?
The last part described about not worrying about the failure, but that the wisdom is still there to be attained if we can hold ourselves in that moment. Is that analogous to what we hear in these rooms of, we're losing our train of thought, looking at the results of something dispassionately and seeing what there is to learn from it, why, in other words, while it's still happening or while it's still fresh?
Yes, we think that's part of it, but there's the other part of it, the injunction that regret is really harmful. You're supposed to look at what was done and learn from it so you don't repeat your mistakes. But if you dwell on the failure, you dwell on what you did wrong, you are living in the past and you're not setting up better causes. So we think it's twofold. Yes?
And regret is productive only of error. So you're actually
reinforcing
it, and then you'll be producing more error.
Right. And in this case, he's saying that just because you failed at something, and we think every one of us remembers from school, maybe in one case, we know we failed so badly in geometry we couldn't even look at ourselves because it seemed pathetic. And that failure made us great at geometry because we decided we were ashamed. So sometimes a failure can make you boost yourself, but not if you're focused on the failure. So the point is that you are no less because you failed. And sometimes the mistakes lead to the realization. Yes?
Two items. If you were talking about Lao Tzu tonight, what were the 10,000 things? And the second part is, I notice I have many regrets and they run in a pattern. And even after many vows and pledges intercept them, I duplicate them instead.
Well, the 10,000 things I don't think belong to Lao Tzu. Mm. Wasn't that Milo Repu? Yes.
It wasn't in the Tao Te Ching. And, I read a few versions of it, and they mentioned that 10,000 things is just means things that are tangible, that could mean anything, the chair, instead of saying everything.
Oh, it's, they just...
We just say 10,000.
Okay, so it's an expression in the Tao Te Ching. Well, we would recommend that you read many different versions of it, because sometimes you won't understand something as well, and then you come across someone who has a sort of poetical approach, and it's not just easier, it's deeper for you.
I'd like to go back to an earlier question as well, because it kind of rang a bell, but I didn't have it at the time. There is this that he wrote as part of those 500 characters. When your work is done and fame has been achieved, then retire into the background, for this is the way of heaven. All things alike do their work, and then we see them subside. When they have reached their bloom, each returns to its origin. Returning to their origin means rest or fulfillment of destiny. This reversion is an eternal law. So that's
very nice.
And that goes along with the cycle in nature. After the bloom, there's a seed. So that's the circle. That's very good.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we also heard in that the difference between thus I know and thus have I heard, the humble.
And the importance of thus have I passed on. The same teachings in the way I was given them. He's supposed to have said this: I love and reverence the ancients, for their writings are so far-reaching and comprehensive that I never weary of studying them. They are an inexhaustible mine of wealth. And so it is that when I write, I care little to originate new ideas, but confine myself as much as possible to compiling and elaborating everything taught by the sacred wise men of old. This was a soul with deep reverence for wisdom. Yes?
So what would he say then, when the quotes were being read, it was said about doing something and trying to do it in secret. So what would happen then if the person would be found out, what is this person's reaction should be?
There is a quote that he who shines is not valuable. That, in other words, he was concerned about those who work in the public and try to make themselves known. He did write, I have three precious things which I hold fast and prize. The first is gentleness, the second is frugality, and the third is humility, which keeps me from putting myself before others. Be gentle, and you can be bold. Be frugal, and you can be liberal. Avoid putting yourself before others, and you can become a leader among men. It was said that he taught by life. I believe that was Confucius writing about Lao Tzu. He didn't teach by lip. It wasn't what he said and how he shone forth, but rather he retired into himself, pray within the closet of your heart, meditate on what is true, do the service, and then withdraw again, come out of the limelight. We have in other texts, certainly, a statement of step into the shade so that others can step into the sunshine. I think he would have loved that.
We think, though, in addition, that if someone does something in the light of the quiet way and they're found out, someone realizes that they've done it, they haven't done anything wrong in the other discovering it, and it would be their reaction. If they would know how well they're doing by how they reacted, if they were pleased that the other recognized it. But it's also a necessary part. I mean, we have to be challenged in our growth, or we don't grow evenly. Yes?
There really are quite a lot of people that do good turns and are very quiet about it, and even when brought to their attention, they just kind of acknowledge that they did it, but that's it. They don't talk about anything. It's like then they move on. They change the subject because they're actually embarrassed.
They don't want it.
They don't want it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They reject it, but they don't reject it in such a way as, you know, they just quietly acknowledge and then move on.
We knew a gentleman who would always answer, oh, I just act as it was done for me. And just Move on.
Just pay it forward.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here's, oh, go ahead.
Did you respond to that part two of my...
I don't know.
Comment what was, about regret?
Help us. What was part two?
That to repeat regret even in the face of trying to avoid it at great lengths.
Repeat regret.
Repeat the things that cause regret to occur.
Oh, yes.
And have them form in a pattern. And the other thing
but that's a mental choice. We don't have to dwell on the regret part of it. We can dwell on how I want to act,
mm-hmm.
how I will to behave, instead of how I did behave.
And how did it become a preferred way not to discuss service or volunteerism? I hang in certain healing communities where it's recommended, you know, to be quiet about it, but yet it gets brought up as a topic and it gets discussed anyhow. And why should it be kept quiet? What if you're seen doing something wholesome and it's an example to someone?
Well, it isn't that you should do it, you know, in a costume so that no one will ever know it was you. That isn't what's meant. What's meant is you shouldn't do it in a way, so are you all watching? Did you see what I just did? So there's quite a difference. So you're acting, but you're not acting that there should be applause and notice and attention. If it happens, it has nothing to do with what you're doing. It isn't something you're constructing. The one of the things that you read, we were thinking of Lao Tzu's five refinements. Now, we would all like to be refined, wouldn't we? And we probably think of them very differently. Generous without being wasteful. Hardworking without being resentful. Desiring without being greedy. At ease without being haughty, and dignified without being fierce. Interesting description, isn't it? Yes.
It's very interesting, and it's in reference.
I'm sorry, I can't hear out of this ear.
It's
so
interesting because we have to look at the claim China lays to Tibet today politically.
We because don't want to get into political things, though.
But the teachings left Tibet, went to China, and China came back, and they were allies. And we only mentioned that to state that the kingdoms of China were warring. But at one point in time, Tibet and China, on account of the work of these great old teachers, Buddhism spread all over parts of China.
But we have to remember when we're dealing with countries and groups of people and incidents in the past or the present, we are dealing with karma. And unless the individuals that make up that group change, it's going to be repeated again. They will meet each other again as different countries in different circumstances and reenact the same mistakes and problems. Did you?
Yeah, very definitely.
Yes.
There's also another scenario, and this happened in Ireland up until 11 or 1200 AD or CE, was that each wave of invaders came and then adopted the way of the natives. They actually assimilated to the native way of life. So they came to invade, but they stayed and adopted the,
the native
way. Customs and the traditions of the people they had invaded. And it wasn't until the split in the Christian church that things started to, around 11, 1200 and afterwards, that things started to get a little ugly, should we say. But for thousands of years before then, so it is possible, even in China with Tibet, it is possible that Tibet can win over China. I mean, it may sound crazy, but it's happened before.
Time will tell, yes.
So when these changes of location, centers of study, and so forth move in the cycles, Alexandria was mentioned, the burning of the library, and that the only teachings that survived from Lao Tzu were these 500 characters. We are told, are we not, in Theosophy, that there are those, as was mentioned, who know the cycles and see them coming and can protect the teachings in a quiet place until it's time for them to come forward again. So in these cycles of history, at the times when it's appropriate for them to reappear, they do. They're not lost. We know the teachings from Alexandria, a good many of them were saved. And as we
actually, it is said that almost every important document was saved by that lodge of masters. So they have an unbroken record of our history as souls and the knowledge and wisdom that has been put down on paper, that there's a record of it. Yes.
And what we can learn from it, from modern day examples, is when those cycles come and they must repeat themselves until we begin to change them, if things are being taken away from us, we must fight for them, or we may not have the opportunity to have them again.
Well, explain what you mean, taken away from us.
For instance, Theosophy is in print and readily available. May not be the case 10 years from now, 50 years from now. It seems that as we act more selfishly in cycles of evolution, these things are being taken away because it's not our time to have them.
Well,
we've given up the right to them.
Let's turn it back to, though, the individual. It's an individual that's being given these injunctions to act this way. If an individual has all the materials of any science, philosophy, religion, scans them, assumes I've done enough, and doesn't go back to them, that is equivalent to saying to life, to nature, I don't want this. In the same way, our physical health, our mental capacities, all our tendencies, we create for ourselves by how we use what we now have. So yes, it may be pulled back from the world because the world is too selfish. And that makes these teachings dangerous because they point to our spiritual power. But an individual keeps what they go after. So if you love the wisdom, you cannot lose it. You will not only have it within you, but you will find it again in a tangible way in your next life. You can't fail.
And part of the point in his original miscellaneous sayings toward the end of this, use the light that is in you to revert to your natural clearness of sight. Then the loss of the body is unintended by calamity. This is called doubly enduring. So he's also the source of the phrase that a journey of 1,000 miles began with one step. So if we love these ancient ideas and we invest the time and the energy to compare the religions and to compare the philosophies and then to take the commonalities and aspire to internalize them, to synthesize them into our daily lives, we are investing in the Buddhi nature, in that eternal recall within, and we don't lose it. So regardless of what the external circumstances are, we are peopling the astral light with these concepts. We are impressing them in the very substance of heart and soul. There's nothing to be lost.
You know how they always talk about young people who stand in front of the priests of the church and question them and know more about the teachings than the priests do. You're born with something because you've treasured it. But one of our biggest problems is We have to do things. We read something, jump to the conclusion that we understand it, instead of pursuing it and asking ourselves questions about it. And we think the most classic example is the quote that was just given. Ask anyone, what does it mean? The longest journey begins with the first step. And they'll say, I'm on my longest journey. I just took the first step. And that isn't what Lao Tzu said. Lao Tzu said, fix a problem when it's tiny. The biggest oak tree began with a little acorn. You can handle it then. You can fix the problem then when it's little. Make the right start of your journey, because the longest journey begins with a single step. So he was telling us, fix it at the outset, at the beginning, and you will not have as many problems. But if we let it continue, it becomes larger than we are, and then we're overwhelmed and karmically thrown for a loop. Yes?
The Chinese legends and the writings of the teachers seem so short and to the point for Westerners. However, if we just pick up the Bhagavad Gita, Light on the Path, and several other books that we study here, we can understand why we have this particular object. To find that they all seem to be the same. In fact, there's a word in the language called tiao, or tiao. It means the path.
It means what?
The path.
The path.
And we thought that, look up that word, the word path is used in our studies. And what that does is open the eye of a student visitor and show why it is important that we investigate ancient psychologies and religions.
Well, you know, there's also a wealth within every one of us of our own past. Theosophy says we've been incarnating for millions of years. We have within us languages, cultures, civilizations, spiritual teachings, and sometimes reading some of these things will stir or awaken something in us that perhaps we may not see it or know it now, but perhaps we had gained some real wisdom in another life. Yes?
So we have to find our voice and trust our judgment and be willing to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we learn, not to be embarrassed by them, especially if they're not intentionally.
Well, we would add
we
something.
We can be embarrassed, it's okay.
Yes, and being embarrassed.
That's not the worst thing in the world.
No, being embarrassed is fine.
We've been embarrassed many times.
We would like to add to that though. Mistakes are natural, they're a part of learning. But they should never be careless mistakes. If we make a mistake because we didn't make the effort, the only example we can think of is every time we've ever painted a ceiling, everything has to be covered in the entire room because we've never learned to do it. It will always be a mistake. But you cover for your mistakes. You make sure that everything's protected from your stupidity. Now, you do the same thing with your effort at studying anything. You cover yourself so that you don't make stupid mistakes.
In one of the paradoxical statements in the original text, it's failure is the foundation of success and the means by which it is achieved. And how many times have we heard certain common things, try again, or there is no effort wasted?
Yes?
We just had this amazing thought in Spanish, the word embarazado means pregnant.
Yes.
Mm.
When we are embarrassed, maybe we are about to
give birth to something better.
Realization right. of what it is that we held, and all of a sudden it doesn't fit.
Right.
And it's a gift to look and see what it was instead of quickly brushing it away.
Well, you know, we're usually only embarrassed when we know we didn't do what we should have done. Then we're embarrassed. Otherwise, if somebody points something out, we're usually just grateful because it's an opportunity to learn more. Yes?
Wasn't there a speech there about failure in your talk tonight? Something about...
Yes, it was from Lao Tzu rather than from quiet way. To one who had failed, despair only adds to a man's ills. Go home. And where is home? Your own spiritual nature.
And of course, in the teachings that we study with the Gita, the voice of silence, every failure is success, so why are you looking for success?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're not looking for success, are we? Mm-mm. What we would like is discrimination. And success is something you go around boasting about. Discrimination is something you use. It's something vital and alive, and it will be used in every area of your life. That's why it's priceless. So it's not success per se. Yes?
If one pursues his own path, would you not say all the things that he needs to do for this incarnation will come to him on the karma?
Yes and no. Yes, in pursuing our own path, it's our own karma that will unfold, but there may be more help for us if we reach to someone like Lao Tzu or Judge or HPB. Yes?
I don't see that if we're following our own path that we should go around reaching to anybody, because if we are to meet them, they will be in our path. And it seems to me that when we start reaching all around on our own volition, we may miss our own path unconsciously.
Well, there's two ways of looking at that, because there is the idea that something may be in my path, but if I don't recognize it as valuable, it might as well not be in my path. Yes.
Perhaps this idea of reaching out to Lao Tzu, maybe we actually mean reaching out to the ideas that are presented by all of the great ones. And it would seem that if we do reach out to those ideas, and if we do culture ourselves by study and application of those ideas, then we would grow in certain ways whereby we can handle even more karma as we grow than we ever would have had we not reached out and applied those ideas.
And there's, you know, we are all on our own path. I mean, we are individuals. We are thinkers in incarnation. And that path is only evident to each one of us. No one can judge it. No one can say we're doing what's right or wrong. But we shouldn't think of it as my path. We should think of it as our path. And just as it says about, you know, build boats so that you can help ferry people across, you should be ready on that path to aid and assist anyone and everything. Now you were going back.
Yeah, there's an ancient Chinese adage that I was unable to find in these particular pages, and that is there are many paths up the top to the top of the mountain. The view from the top of the mountain is identical, is the very same. In the latter document, The Quiet Way, the Lord Superior invites the people who are seeking goodness to come to him in any way that they may be pleased to follow. They may pay homage of the Dallas Sanctuary. They may worship the Northern Constellation. They may bow before the Buddha and recite his sutras. If they only do so with singleness and sincerity of heart, these roads will lead to goodness, and there should be no thought of attaining blessings or acquiring rewards. So if the motive is correct and there's no attachment to the fruits of the labor, that path followed with a singleness of I'm going to do my duty with a spiritual simplicity and focus will bring that soul to the loftiness of the Lord.
Our time is up. We'll see you tomorrow, we hope, 1 to 3:30.
Building opens at 12:30.